There's a woman called Mary who's off in search of a lectern, so if she appears, that'll be very welcome. But otherwise, I want to say thank you to Greenbelt for inviting me to come and talk again this year. I suspect it would have been easier to have a conversation, which I hope we will have, if it was a more intimate venue than this, but that was beyond my control. But I hope that we will have some time for exchange towards the end of the session for comments and questions and some crosstalk. For myself, what I'm going to try and do today is I'm going to do some thinking, which is slightly thinking aloud. It's not just off the top of my head, but it is thinking aloud. And you might feel it turns into a bit of a rant, but there's a place for rants. And it'll be helpful for me, because of that, to get some reaction from you at the end. See, somebody's off already. That's just been the last straw for them. Some of you may know, the last couple of years I've been involved with sessions which have been looking at elements of political theology. So a couple of years ago I did something on Gordon Brown, our glorious leader, and the way people connect him to ideas about Presbyterianism and Calvinism. And then last year, something about breaking up Britain, and how and why we should be nationalists if we're Christians. It's been quite a good year to be a nationalist, actually, but that's painful for some people here, so I won't go into that. Today I want to talk about political parties, and I want to do what I think we come here to Greenbelt to do, certainly what I come to Greenbelt to do, which is to reflect together on issues, including political issues, in the light of Scripture and Christian tradition. And we do this in a setting where there is freedom to question, and there's freedom to argue, and there's freedom to debate, but there's also a commitment to doing this as brothers and sisters, in a spirit of mutual respect, a spirit of openness to one another's positions. Now, that may seem either too obvious or too pious, but I am concerned that we need to take more seriously than we sometimes do the ethics of conversations that we have with one another in public settings. The ethics of conversation are really important. And my concern about the ethics of conversation and public conversations is one of the things that drives my concern about the state of political parties at the moment. So I want to repeat that I think that Greenbelt is a good place to do this. It may even be one of the best places in the UK to do this. And it's part of what's most precious to me about this festival, that it has over many years become a good place to talk. A good place to talk. And I don't think we should underestimate how rare those places can be in public, and how much we need to value them, and how they don't happen very often. They don't happen by accident. They need to be worked at, they need to be created, they need to be nurtured, and we need to build a culture where there is a good space to talk, and maybe particularly in terms of talking about politics. And I think Greenbelt is one of those good spaces. I'm feeling a bit nostalgic about Greenbelt this year. Maybe it's the Larry Norman tribute, which I hope you're all going to go to. Maybe it's talk of a new Scottish event called Scotbelt, which we're talking about tonight. I may not be called Scotbelt, that's just what we're calling it by the by. And perhaps it's just advancing years, but I'm more and more aware of how significant Greenbelt has been in my own journey over the past 25 years. See, I came from a church background where involvement with politics was completely discouraged. You know, it was considered to be something that Christians should have no truck with at all. And so from the age of 16 or 17, Greenbelt has been a key place for me in encouraging me to be politically concerned and politically active, to care about politics and to get involved in political issues. And since I came of age politically in the 1980s, in the Thatcher era, there have been two tracks which have run through my own political thinking, my own political awareness. And the first is what's often called the Christian realist position. The Christian realist position. If you read theology at all, it's associated sometimes with an American theologian, German-American theologian called Reinhold Niebuhr. And he was quite influential in a lot of American politicians and a lot of other people who've been Christians who've become involved in politics. Niebuhr was quite influential. And Niebuhr's thinking stressed the need to face up to the fact that we live in a fallen world. Politics in a fallen world is a messy business, and we have to be highly pragmatic about how far we can work politically to restrain evil and to promote good. So everything's pretty messy, everything's full of compromises. We have to, you know, have fairly limited aspirations to what it's possible to achieve in this difficult environment. And this position was also very big on responsibility. The Plymouth Brethren that I grew up in, you know, belonging to a political party was absolutely out the window. But when I encountered this position through Christian Union as a student and also coming to Greenbelt, there was this big stress on responsibility. You needed to get involved. You needed to get down and dirty, join a political party, make your contribution and get stuck in there and be realistic about the compromises involved. There's a French theologian called Jacques Ellul tells an interesting story about this in a book called The Politics of God and the Politics of Man. He uses the story of Naaman. You remember the story of Naaman, who's the commander of the Syrian army in the Old Testament, who gets healed by dipping in the Jordan? Well, most people focus on the first half of that story and then know about him, you know, not wanting to go in the river. But the second half of the story, he goes back and he decides that he's going to go back and worship the God of Israel when he goes back to Syria. And he even takes a bit of earth from Israel so he can, you know, do his worshipping on some you know, holy ground. But he's got a question that he puts to Elijah. And he says, well, Elijah, the trouble is when I go back, I have to go into the temple of Rimmon with my lord the emperor, and he's a bit frail, and he leans on my arm, and that means that when he bows down to this, you know, foreign god, and he's holding my arm, I have to bow down with him, and I'm really worried that this is going to compromise my newfound faith in the God of Israel. And Elijah says to him, no, that's all right, if you like, you know, God will understand the fact that you have to do that. And Ellul used this as a kind of metaphor for the compromises that you have to be involved in if you become an active politician. Sometimes, you know, because you're arm in arm with powers which are bowing down to other gods, then you have to bow down with them, if you like. But that's somehow okay. So if that was the first political track that ran through my experience, the second one also started early, and it was inspired more by the politics of Martin Luther King and the civil rights struggle in America. It was inspired by early Greenbelt speakers like Jim Ponton and Ron Sider, by Jim Wallace and the Sojourners community. And this was more, you could call it, an idealist track. Whereas the first tradition liked to quote Romans 13 and the powers that wield the sword and the need to be in subjection to authority, the second idealist tradition was much more at ease with the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' words about loving your enemies and going the extra mile and not paying back evil for evil and all that kind of thing. And it stressed nonviolent resistance, it stressed the power of example. It wasn't necessarily wholesale against political parties, but it was interested in other movements and pressure groups and alternative political campaigns. And it was also interested in the church and the church as a political community. And that showed the influence of people like John Howard Yoder, the Mennonite and the Anabaptist traditions. So there have been these two tracks which have run through my own political thinking. And my own journey hasn't really conformed to conventional wisdom. I think the conventional wisdom is that you're meant to start off as a youthful idealist and then you're full of romantic ideas about life and spirituality, and you see a bit of life and you count the cost of resisting evil, you see the complexities of political life, and then you slowly move towards a realist position. So you become a Niebuhrian realist as you go on through life. So I was a kind of Augustinian, Niebuhrian, Calvinist realist at the age of 21. Hey, here's the lectern. That's great. That's great. Straight out of university, at 21, I went to work for the Ministry of Defence in Whitehall under the Thatcher government. And I did so even though I loathed Thatcherism. I was so convinced that I needed to accept my share of the responsibility of being part of a fallen and system that I should do my share of the compromising. So I was a youthful realist, but increasingly I'm turning into an aging idealist. Although I have days when there's a real struggle going on, you know, a Jekyll and Hyde thing. Maybe it's a bit like the Texan theologian Stanley Hauerwas says, "Of course I'm a pacifist, I have to be, I'm such a mean son of a bitch." And maybe I have to be an idealist because instinctively, you know, a lot of other aspects of my theology, I think, lead me in a very realist direction about my expectations of people's behaviour. Well, that was all a bit autobiographical, but I think it's got some relevance to what I want to move on to today. Because in particular, I've been reflecting recently on whether that more realist angle can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Can set up a situation where we have such low expectations of one another and of our institutions that we tolerate things which we should find intolerable. We are in a situation at the moment in the UK where membership of the two largest political parties, Labour Party and the Conservative Party, is in steep decline, very steep decline. The Labour Party had over 400,000 members in 1997. The latest figures are around about 190,000. So in about a decade, it's lost a little over half of its membership. And Labour's probably losing members fastest. The Tory figures are much harder to get a fix on. So it's harder to see. But there was talk after in the period after the war of the Tory party having over a million members. And these days it's now got, you know, something like a quarter of a million members, according to their own estimates. The Lib Dems also in steep decline, maybe at a slightly slower rate than the other two, but they're also going down fast. The Green Party went through a sharp decline in the early 90s, and it's slowly beginning to rebuild its membership, but very slowly, and it's nowhere near its peak numbers of 1990. Just to give you a purely objective report on the state of the parties, I have to say that the nationalist parties are on a rising curve post-devolution. But I think we also need to look at these figures alongside a long-term decline since the 1960s of levels of participation in general elections. And again, this has been much discussed, particularly since the very low turnout of 2001, only just exceeded in 2005. And there's been a lot of talk about a growing alienation from the political process, particularly among young people. And one of the things I'd be interested to hear in the talk back at the end is whether you think this is a real alienation from politics amongst young people, or whether, in particular, it's an alienation from party politics and from political parties, and whether there's a difference there. And maybe some of you will have some comments on that later. But what I'm conscious of is that the realist part of me finds that very troubling and wants to sit down and ask questions about how we can persuade more people to get involved and join political parties again and become active, and wants to rally people to the cause of saving our political parties. And that's a genuine feeling. It really is a genuine feeling. There's part of me that feels like that. But, you know, more and more it's being outweighed by a different response which says, actually, you know what, let's just let them go to hell. And that may be overstating it slightly, but you know what I mean, maybe. And since there are 200,000 others like me who have left the Labour Party since 1997, I figured it might be worth taking some time to debrief what some of us have gone through. And I want to suggest that it can be unpacked into five serious objections to the current state of party politics. Now, not all of my points apply equally to all political parties, although all of them apply with almost equal force to both Labour and the Conservatives. Okay, so five serious objections to the current state of party politics. First of all, parties are bad places to talk about politics. And this is a big one for me. I think a party needs to be able to claim that it's a healthy arena for political discourse and debate. It needs to be a good place to talk about politics. And I'm not at all convinced that our political parties offer us that. I left the Labour Party because I simply could not believe or accept the tone of voice in which the party tried to communicate with me as one of its members in the 1990s. I felt, quite honestly, we were being treated like idiots. and increasingly like idiots who shouldn't expect to have any meaningful role in a political conversation. There was a lot of rhetoric about the grassroots and grassroots involvement, but the reality was that a culture of centralised control was developing as part of the Blairite project, which believed, really, you can only conclude that they believed that policy making was the function of an elite who knew best what the party programme should be. And that elite were essentially offering a deal to party members. We will give you the message and you will try to stay on message. We'll give you what in the civil service used to be called the line to take, and your job is to take it. And in return, we will take the party into government. Give up on participation and we will give you power. And in doing that, I think Labour were effectively mimicking the habits of the Tories under Thatcher. The idea really that there was no alternative. People who wanted to debate the alternatives were troublemakers who needed to be subjected to party discipline. So what we were being offered was a political culture where the two dominant metaphors were whip and spin. Whip and spin politics. Toe the line and sell the line. Let me read a quote from Jackie Ashley, the Guardian political commentator, in 2003. She's not my favourite commentator, by the way, but she wrote this about New Labour in 2003. While talking of a mass membership party, the Blairites actually ran things as a centralised, top-down, permanent coup. It was about control, not internal democracy, and it still is. And she says, if democracy doesn't have local roots, it isn't democracy. You cannot have a parliamentary system based on political parties if across most of the country they've ceased to exist. And I think she was right. Parties with their twin tools of whip and spin have become bad places to talk about politics. So why should we want to talk politics within them? What's so attractive about living under a permanent coup? Who needs it apart from people whose careers depend upon it? My second complaint is bound up with this, and it's that parties have become bad examples of participative democracy. I remember an early Jim Wallace writing where he said something very powerful and striking about the churches. He said, "We've nothing more to share with the world than we have ourselves." And I think he's right about that in the churches, and I think he's also his comments could also be applied to political parties. The great Christian socialist thinker R.H. Tawney used to speak about socialism as fellowship. Now, call me a hippie or a fanatic, but I think that there's an issue of integrity here. If we want to claim that our party is deeply committed to developing and extending democracy, those within it should be experiencing a way of belonging to that party which looks like and feels like and smells like democracy from the inside as well. And if they don't, there's something wrong. And instead, what I think parties have been delivering to their members over the last few years is a growing cult of leadership. They're not alone in this. I think the L word is becoming one of my least favoured and least trusted words. In schools and business and churches, the 90s and the noughties have been awash with leadership talk and worryingly quiet on democracy talk. I'm not a major fan of Tony Benn either, but I like his power questions. What power have you got? Where did you get it from? In whose interest do you exercise it? To whom are you accountable? And how do we get rid of you? And those are important questions for democracy. Alongside the cult of leadership came the ruthless taming of party structures. Anthony Sampson suggests that party conferences used to involve fierce and intimate debates. Well, not any longer, because they've become largely stage-managed processes where the members are there to provide standing ovations for the leaders and opportunities to embarrass the leadership have been systematically removed. Policy-making processes in the two major parties have been reformed into near irrelevance, with the rules of the game being very clear that the leadership will go its own way regardless of any pesky votes which are taken by the membership. And again, why would you want to be part of this? Why be a member of an institution which treats its members like that? Only because the project promises to deliver for you. The loss of internal democracy to the permanent coup is the price you pay for being in government. You have to accept a severe democratic deficit within your own party. At the last general election, the other Guardian columnist, Polly Toynbee, said people should hold their noses and vote Labour. And clearly many people did that. But what's becoming obvious is that there are hundreds of thousands of people who will not hold their noses and join Labour anymore. And I think that is cause for concern and reflection. My third objection to parties as they are currently constituted within our political system is that they encourage unduly adversarial behaviour. They exacerbate division and they fuel habits of ritual abuse and belittling of each other's positions. And this is where I'm back to the ethics of public conversation. Tony Wright, who is a Labour MP who was chair of the Public Accounts Committee, said this in a debate in the Westminster Parliament. He was talking about why the Hutton Inquiry seemed to have done so much better than some of the select committees in getting insights into what had happened around the Iraq War. And he said, of course, we know what happens. We all play a game. Perhaps, he says, it's time to tell the public about it. We rally round, do nothing that gives comfort to our opponents and support our own side. Only any notion of public interest loses out. Perhaps it's time to tell the public. Actually, Tony, I think most of the public already knew that. And this begins, and I think it's sometimes at its shrillest within student politics. Take the SNP and the Labour Party in Scotland. And I said this last year when I was talking about nationalism. The levels of mutual contempt and loathing which are often on display between these two parties, I think is very, very disturbing. This is between two social democratic parties which have many, many policy goals in common. And doubtless we'll see more of this in the upcoming by-election in Glenrothes. But the level of abuse which is set out and the time spent in just attack politics between the two parties, I think has gone beyond what we should find tolerable and acceptable. And I think it's telling what's happened to the word partisan. If a politician really wants you to take seriously something they're saying, very often they'll say, I'm not making a partisan point here. And see how the word partisan, your involvement with your party, has become something which you're acknowledging, in a sense, damages your own integrity when you make that kind of statement. There's an implicit acknowledgement that partisan talk is simply really attack talk, which has accepted the need to bracket fairness and openness to someone else's position in the interests of the party. As Disraeli said, damn your principles, stick to your party. Fourth objection, parties are bad at encouraging wider political participation. Again, this is not particularly surprising given what we've just said. Do we expect parties to be turning people onto politics? No, and they're not. Do we expect them to encourage a culture of political debate and participation? Well, maybe no, and they're not. The answer seems obvious, and the growth of disengagement from politics and cynicism about politicians is not wholly, but it's partly due to this. I think this also lies behind what I think is a deep and wide public hostility to the public funding of political parties. I think lots of us feel you want me to support the use of our taxes so that you can mount ever more expensive campaigns of whip and spin, do more billboard advertising, put more leaflets through my door so you can market your policy positions to me. Our political parties are part of the problem of declining participation in politics. And then finally, my fifth objection, and here some parties must be at least partially exempted, but to greater and lesser extent, parties avoid serious reform of the political process because they prize the advantages of its unfairness too much. And the elephant on the lawn here, of course, is the grossly disproportionate first-past-the-post voting system. Now, prior to 1997, if various accounts are to be believed, Tony Blair and others were toying with what was called big tent politics, looking back at a century in which the progressive forces, so-called, had spent too much time in opposition, Labour and Liberals. They were saying, well, maybe we should move towards big tent politics and consider reform of the voting system. The trouble is, once they won such a thumping majority, all those aspirations just seem to evaporate. The advantages of having a grossly disproportionate, undeserved majority and the power that came with it were just too seductive. And there's some honourable exceptions, like the late Robin Cook, who, you know, all his political career campaigned for PR. But for the most part, the seductions of the power that's delivered by that, even if it's not your turn at the moment, are too great for people to commit themselves to reform. And of course, one of the interesting things about the present Scottish government is it's been a government without a majority, which I think is probably a good discipline for any party to go through at some point. So those are my five major complaints about the toxic effects of political parties on the political process. Let me give you a quote from someone else who's not my favourite commentator. This is from John Major, 2003. He says, "At the grassroots, our political parties are shrinking in membership from mass movements to the size of special interest groups. The broad mass of the nation is detached from politics. Many feel a distaste for it. All the party machines are moribund, near bankrupt, unrepresentative, and ill-equipped to enthuse the electorate." Go, John. It's one of the only things you've ever said that I agreed with. So what is to be done? Well, I'm going to come back with five suggestions for what I think should be done about this, and then you can let loose at me for what I've said. I want to think whether there are some common strategies which Christians might agree on, even if our political allegiances are not entirely cut from the same cloth. And I'm going to suggest that there are some responses that I think we should be able to agree on. And one thing is, I think it might start with overcoming some of our reticence about moralizing. Our job as Christians is not just to get down and dirty with the world as it is. We're called to a vision of transformed and transforming practice. And that should be true not just for Christians, but for Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs and humanists as well. But we start from where we are. And I think we need to become bolder about our commitment to a tradition of political virtues. Political virtues. The pursuit of virtue, the idea of training in virtue, have become big themes in Christian ethics within recent years. Now, I think they do need to be handled carefully because, unlike Tony Blair, I think it's one of the defining marks of a Christian that they do have a reverse gear. That we are a repentant and a penitent people who are always conscious of our own fallibility. We are not people who never apologize and never explain. That's not part of Christian virtue and identity as I understand it. But the realist theme of human sinfulness, I think, needs to be set alongside a theme which is growing in importance, an idealist appeal to pursuing virtue and being self-conscious about that. And if we think theologically about transforming politics, we'll draw on the tradition of Christian virtues. But I think we'll also remember that there's some other key issues about Christian community which have been worked out through church history. And here I want to quote from some work by Oliver O'Donovan, who's the professor of practical theology in Edinburgh. And he's written a lot about some of the Christian influences on the development of parliamentary democracy in the past. And in particular, he points to the way in which Congregationalist and Baptist traditions developed church meetings in which anyone could have a voice. And those church meetings, when the Pilgrim Fathers went to America, you know, many of you will know, became the basis of the New England town meetings that are still reflected very faintly in bits of the American political process. But they developed these church meetings because they believed, O'Donovan says, that they had certain beliefs about the way in which the Holy Spirit is given to the church and the way in which God speaks to the church through the Spirit. Because God could speak through anyone and through the least prominent or important members of the body. And if that was true, if that was what you believed about how God could speak to the church, then you had to create political structures within your church which reflected that and allowed that to be expressed and enacted. The Anabaptist theologian John Howard Yoder says something very similar in a little book called Body Politics. He calls it the rule of Paul, and he bases it on 1 Corinthians 14 and what Paul says about people, in a sense, having a right to speak, being given the opportunity to speak within meetings of the church. So alongside Christian virtues of humility and honesty, of gentleness and peaceableness, alongside the commitment to love our neighbor who we're debating with or competing with politically, we have this very basic understanding from Scripture and Christian tradition that we are meant to shape structures in which we can at least sometimes hear God's voice through the voice of any member of the body, and particularly those who might be considered the least. So I think theology is important here, and there's much more that could be said, but I want to finish with a kind of answering 5 points to the 5 complaints I made at the beginning. So 5 ideas about a possible shared Christian response to the state our parties are in. First of all, I want to defend rather vigorously the option of leaving or not joining political parties, of opting out of the system as it stands. And I want to defend it against that old realist line that it's irresponsible by arguing that shaking the dust off your feet against people can sometimes be a deeply responsible act. It's made more responsible if you have a commitment alongside that to engage with political culture in other ways, in other levels. But it's a bit like the graffiti, don't vote, it only encourages them. Don't join, it only encourages them, we could see. And maybe it'll take further critical decline and even financial bankruptcy for some parties to accept that they need to change. They need to change the experience of what it means to be a member of that party. And I think it's an option to say don't join until these parties change and make it feel different and count for something different to be a member of your party. My second concern is that we need good places to talk about politics in our society and our culture. And since parties are not offering them, I think we need to seek out other places which are and be intentional about creating them where they don't exist. And we should value, as I said, spaces like Greenbelt. This is an important space for dialogue. It's a creative, it's a generous space. Let's value it and let's use it. It's interesting to note that churches in the UK have something going for them here. Churches are amongst the leading groups who organise hustings when it comes to parliamentary elections and elections for the Scottish and Welsh parliaments. Within our own churches and Christian communities, we have valuable spaces and arenas for political debate and discussion and education. And I think we probably don't use them enough. Probably again because the old Niebuhrian thing, we're worried about being stuck in a ghetto and being too introverted. But there's a lot of research around at the moment which suggests that within civil society, the levels of participation displayed by citizens are in direct relationship to involvement in institutions like churches. So it's a key indicator of whether you're going to be an active member of civil society if you're involved with a church. So maybe we need to value the political spaces within our churches. And chances are that many of us might get more people talking about political issues at a meeting our church hosted than you would get at a local branch meeting of many political parties. If we want to have a different political culture, then we have to anticipate it and incarnate it and practice it in other spaces, because the parties are not going to do that for us to the degree that they need to be doing it. I think voluntary organisations have a key role here and are playing a key role here, and also the internet, web-based discussion groups and forums. There are many new spaces opening up within our society to talk about politics. There are better spaces than the political parties. So let's use them. A third suggestion is to be an unreliable friend to your party. If you are a party member, be a disloyal party member and work transgressively. And here I want to give you the example of Bob Holman, who's one of my great heroes, long-time Labour Party member. And he's become friends with Ian Duncan Smith after a visit by Smith to Easter House. And recently, Bob Holman wrote a column in the Glasgow Herald saying why he was joining a working group on issues to do with asylum seekers and refugees at the Centre for Social Justice, which is really a Tory organisation, a Tory think tank or campaigning group. This is somebody who, you don't get more old Labour, if you like, than Bob Holman. He might be sitting here, I don't know. If you're out there, wave to me, Bob. But you don't get much more old Labour than that. And yet, he's so disgusted by his own party's position on these issues that he's willing to work transgressively and send a signal. He's not going to resign from the Labour Party, but he wants to work transgressively and say there are bigger things going on here than just following the party line on this kind of issue. And my fourth suggestion is that I think we need to not give up on the idea of joining things or of signing people up. We need to build a new culture of subscription. And I think a really good model here is Oxfam's recent campaign, Count Me In, or I'm In. Oxfam is looking for 1 million people to sign a very simple pledge. I think poverty is an injustice, and I want to do something about it. And we may have to start the task of rebuilding institutions for political participation further back than political parties. But we shouldn't give up on the need to build a culture of subscription. I think there are lots of signs that young people in these islands care passionately about political issues. They are ready to say, count me in, but their instincts are leading them towards Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Oxfam, Christian Aid, Tradecraft, not towards the traditional political parties. And it may be that rather than something which is patronised or viewed just as a step in the right direction, we may need to consider whether the Google generation, the internet generation, whether they are actually going to create new vehicles for participation and political activism which are not going to look the same as the old style political parties. And maybe festivals are part of that, whether it's Greenbelt or it's Glastonbury. But I think we need a new and a different culture of subscription. And my own worry about public funding of political parties is that we will let people off the hook in terms of developing this, needing to go out and establish a base of people who care about the vision of your party and are willing to contract in and support it if we go too far down the public funding route. And my fifth response, take a wee drink before I launch into this one, is to argue that I think it's absolutely crucial that we argue and campaign for proportional representation at all levels of our political institutions. And I want to give you an example. I am deeply opposed to the ethos and the traditions and many of the policies of the Conservative Party. And I don't think that goes against the ethics of the kind of conversation that I'm talking about to say that. And after Thatcherism, I rejoiced as Scotland was swept clear of the last remaining Tory MP. But after the first wave of gloating, which I did really enjoy, I have to say, after the first wave of gloating subsided, I actually thought this is really kind of disgraceful to feel like this. The complete disenfranchisement of Scotland's Conservative voters at Westminster is something to be ashamed of. Even though I may disagree profoundly with that party's position, I do not want them to have no representation. And one of the good effects of introducing PR for the Scottish Parliament is that the Tories have actually been given back a serious representation within Holyrood. Now, as far as I'm concerned, may it never be more than a rump. But let it be fair, and let it be proportionate. Now, while it's only fair that I admit now to being a peripheral and heavily hedged member of the SNP, can I also say that I'm enormously glad, personally, that we are dependent on the votes of the Scottish Green Party for a majority in debates at Holyrood. I think it's good for the SNP, and I think it's good for Scotland. So there goes any chance I ever had of getting a seat. No, I wasn't looking for one. The party's over. Question mark. And maybe what I'm trying to say is that we should care less if it is. Maybe we should treat the current political class with a bit less deference, be less mesmerised by what they think politics is, and more assertive about finding our own voices and our own visions. More ready to make our own politics in parallel through new and different channels. I've become a bit scunnered about both Christian and academic events where the organisers are desperate to get party politicians to show up at them. In most cases, not all, there's honourable exceptions, some of whom are here today, I've got to say that. But in most cases that I've experienced, the results were usually fairly pathetic. The politician would show up, almost always late, give a rubbish, unoriginal and unexceptional speech and leave early, but not before a photo opportunity with some of the organisers of the event in question. We do not need to be so mesmerised by that kind of power. There are many different kinds of power within our society. The power to name and shame, the power to protest and campaign, the power of example, the power of cooperation, the power of art, and the power of prayer. And all of those things are powerful, and all of them are political. Stanley Howard Vass would say that the cross shows us above all that our lives are not so much about winning as they are about witnessing. This side of heaven, our calling is not to be victors so much as it is to be martyrs in the sense of being witnesses. And maybe we get the political parties we deserve, but maybe we don't. And maybe we can and should do something to bear witness to that. Maybe we should send a signal that in terms of things being done as they have been, the party's over. Thank you very much. Well, I think, you know, I ranted at you. You rant back at me or make comments. It doesn't have to be a question, you know, but I'd love to hear some exchange and comment and feedback about these things.
Thank you so much. I read Jim Wallace 30 years ago, joined the L'Arche community, and more recently have been quite a member of the Emerging Church. And for years I've apologized for not being in party politics. Thank you for giving me permission to go on being quietly radical.
Doug, thanks for your talk there. It was interesting, but as you talked, I kept on thinking, you know, there's not one of these objections that you have to the parties that you couldn't also say about denominational church here in Great Britain. And if that's true, then obviously the remedies which you were suggesting, i.e. leaving, are also relevant. How would you respond to that? Or was that what you were trying to say to begin with?
I think I'm saying that you if you're going to leave a party, and I think what I was trying to say is I think that can be a valid option. Now, I've done a calculation that at the moment, for me being a kind of peripheral, disloyal member of the SNP, I can just about live with, and I think it's doing more good than harm in my life. I'm comfortable if people, you know, but what I was saying was that I think it's only really a responsible act if you are committed to being politically involved in other ways. And I think there is a good case that can be made, and I think what the first speaker said was very much part of that. I'm comfortable to say that about the church as well. I'm still hanging in as part of the Church of Scotland. I think that's right. You know, it's losing members almost as fast as the Labour Party, but not quite. There's a lot of issues that we've got to face about that. And I respect people. But if you still want to be Christian, then I think you leave a church like that because you think you can more effectively be church outside it. And I respect people who are doing that, even though it's not my my path at the moment.
Hi, Doug. Thank you very much indeed. That was enlightening. I'm a card-carrying Tory, and I'm very glad I'm out of range. I was just wondering, I completely agree with you on the funding of political parties. It shouldn't be public. It gives people a free
rate. Nor should millionaires like Ashcroft to be able to fund the Tories to the extent they do, as far as I'm concerned. But.
Thank you for the interruption, and I'll give you the trade unions. It is about witnessing rather than winning. I completely agree. But before you go changing an electoral system, would it not be a better idea to put on that voting form none of the above? To actually give people the chance to come out and say, this is it, put your cross in this box, and if enough people do that, you turn around and say, here is your democracy, now we change it.
It's an interesting idea. I don't think it's going to happen. And I suppose in a sense, I think people are doing that by not voting and by leaving political parties. And I think that should be enough of a signal to us that there's a need to change. I don't think we need a plebiscite on whether there's a need for change, personally.
Hi, Doug. Thank you very much for your analysis of the situation. I thought it was really interesting, and I can really relate to the Jekyll and Hyde situation that you find yourself in a lot of the time. I'm still a member of the Labour Party and also vice chair of the Christian Socialist Movement, and we deal with that kind of tension, kind of holding a midway point on quite a regular basis. What I really wanted to encourage people here, actually, was picking up on another point that a gentleman made about the similarities between church and political parties as institutions, was really to look at creative ways in which they can be more antagonistic, I suppose, and raise issues and try to create maybe parallel events within their political parties where they can actually meet and discuss and kind of create spaces for political discourse. Because I do think it's possible, and I think instead of just criticising sometimes, I'm not saying that's all you were doing, but as members of political parties, it's very easy, as it is in the church, just to say, fine, I don't get on with this, it's not engaging me, rather than actually trying to be creative about constructing political discourse.
Hi, I didn't disagree with many of your 5 points, but at the same time, hearing them, I'd still want to make a plea for people staying in. I think that I can hear those 5 points, and actually on one or two of them, say amen and hallelujah, particularly as a member of the Labour Party, who's been in it since 83 and can remember what that was like. I'm glad they stopped listening to the membership. I'm actually quite glad that the party became a moderating influence, and I'm really glad that they went on to win. And I actually would rather they did that. As someone who works in education, I'd rather have them winning and winning. I'm looking forward to them winning again.
Well, I find that a sad sentence, so I'm glad they stopped listening to the members. I mean, we've got to be able to do better than that. I'm not saying I disagree with you about who would I rather have had in power over the last 10 years, but we've got to be able to do better than that, and we deserve better than that as members of parties.
Hold it up, close your
mouth. What would you say to making voting compulsory and penalising people for not exercising what is a hard-won right?
Yeah, I'm personally not in favour of that, but I would rather use carrot rather than stick, personally.
Yeah. Hi. Interesting what you said. Speaking as a membership secretary of a local party, and also as somebody who's just finished a by-election campaign on a local authority, it's been interesting speaking to people, because a lot of people seem to feel disenfranchised from the political process. And a lot of them say it's just not worth it because they're all the same. Is it not time that real democracy was actually introduced to political parties? I'm fortunate. I'm a member of, I think, the only major political party that has one member, one vote. Is it not time we forced this on all of them and took away the power of trade unions within Labour and the power of big business within Tories?
Yeah, I'm very cautious about what you should try and force on people. I think restrictions on spending are the one key area that I think I would like to see serious restrictions introduced and some element of compulsion. And it would have to be even-handed, as the person said, and try and find a way of it being even-handed. But that's about as far as you know, I would like to see. I don't think you can try and get the state writing the constitutions of political parties. They've got to be able to do that themselves. And if they don't have enough fairness and hospitality and humility and generosity and all the other things you need to do to write a constitution, then we're in trouble. And in fact, we are in trouble.
Doug, thanks very much for sharing with us today. And you know, what you were saying about the importance that every person within a political party has the opportunity to put forth their view and to have that respected. And I do understand what's happened within political parties in terms of the control that we've seen over past decades. However, I have two key concerns with what you've said today. Firstly, is around the five objections that you gave, and they came through quite strongly. And I'm not a party political member, and I'm sure there are many people here who aren't today either, but I came hoping that you would encourage me to become a member of a party, but through your objections, I'm not convinced of that. And secondly, is what hasn't come through is the importance of leadership within political parties and the importance of leadership within government. And there is a time when people have to unite in order to progress and to move forward and see the changes that we need within this country and across the globe.
Yeah, if I was discouraging, see, the Jekyll and Hyde thing, you know, the realist, the Niebuhrian realist part of my brain is really quite anxious about the fact that I've discouraged you further from joining a party. I think what I'm above all wanting to say is I'm not imagining some kind of utopia where I think we can do away with the idea of parties altogether. What I want is for more people to say, you need to make your party worth belonging to in a way that it is not at the moment. And I think we need to say that much more loudly to people. So it's not about saying that in principle there is something evil or bad about belonging to a political party. It's about saying that I think this realism, this sense of go out and get involved, get down and dirty, make the compromises, has not given us a strong enough Christian voice for reform. And I want to say that to the Christian socialist movement as well. You know, are you the reforming voice that you should be in relation to the Labour Party, in relation to theological reflection about what a political party should look like? Does that come across? Does the party feel you procedurally, organisationally, constitutionally as a force of conscience within it? Because I don't think it does.
You've put most of the blame for the decline of party membership squarely on the parties themselves. But there's plenty of evidence that there's decreasing involvement in public life from trade unions to parent-teacher associations. Almost any kind of area of civic life has had a dramatic decline in the number of people getting involved. And isn't that saying something about our wider public culture, not just the political parties, which is quite worrying, and it's about a much more individualistic kind of society we're living in? And how do we kind of tackle that? Because I'm not saying everyone who isn't involved in civic life are being selfish, but is there a danger that there is a kind of individualism that can become a kind of selfishness, and that is reflected in the declining party membership?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point, and I just want to reinforce two things that I did say. The first is I said political parties are only partly to blame for this, they're not wholly to blame for it. And the second thing I said was we need to rebuild a culture of subscription. And I think we need to think about how we do that. And I think there is a lot. There is beginning to be some serious thinking about this done within political parties. Because people, if you had a senior position, you know, in an organisation whose membership was falling as dramatically, certainly, you know, as a Church of Scotland minister, I'm doing a lot of very serious theological reflection about why the church is declining in the way it is and what we need to do about it. You know, most weeks of my life, I'm thinking about that at some point. You know, you would hope that the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the Lib Dems were doing the same and were ready to make some real meaningful changes, which we're going to begin to help to rebuild this culture of joining in, participation, subscription. And it may be that we have to do this against the cultural tide, against the cultural stream, but that makes it an even more urgent task if it's a good thing to do. And I think it is a good thing to do. I want to see people engaged and involved and participating. Therefore, we need to think hard about how that's going to happen.
Hi, Doug. I'm down here. Sorry. In between, yeah. I just wanted to say, without really commenting too deeply, thanks for having the same amount of solutions you put forward to critics that you put forward as a commentator. I rarely hear that from any speaker. So I just want to say I appreciate that.
Hi, Doug. I think I've picked up from your talk that you have experience of trying to register your protest by leaving the Labour Party, and you encourage us to do the same. So as a member of the Labour Party, my question is, do you have any evidence that the Labour Party heard your protest? And if I were to leave, would it not be just put down as further indication of increasing apathy rather than increased engagement?
I can't possibly speak for the Labour Party on that issue. I don't know. And you know, as I say, I'm not advocating disengagement. I think what I'm looking for is also to validate other forms of engagement in a way which I think one of the main Christian cultures and theological cultures that I was involved in that encouraged me to get involved with politics, there was this sense that unless you were going down the route of party membership, you really weren't, you know, playing a responsible part and taking your full share of the difficulty of the political task. And I wanted to raise some questions about that. I did say at the beginning that I was thinking aloud, and I'm trying to think about it as well, you know, and I think that having a conversation and you know, saying to Greenbelt, I want to give this talk, I want to start this conversation, not start this conversation, that sounded ridiculously, you know, arrogant. I want to, you know, create a space in which some of this conversation can take place at Greenbelt and say that I think this is important. I think that's a political act in itself, and I think it's about engagement. We need to engage. Can the person with the microphone, I know... my friend Elizabeth over here really wants to talk as well in a minute, so it's important her voice is heard.
Now or after? I need to say thank you first. I'm not even at this talk. I'm having lunch at the back, and you've drawn me in, so thank you. I've got a question about the mix of a popular voice and a leadership voice, and what mix is necessary to address long-term difficult questions. I'm thinking particularly, for example, of climate change, where the political parties can't do it because they, even though they don't want popular engagement, they're still trying to win the popular vote. But the mix of voices coming from the population hasn't historically given long, wise, long-term thinking. How do we get a mix that maintains democracy to address long-term issues?
I think it's a really great question. I just want to leave that as one for us to... I don't have a quick response to it. I think it's a profound... it's a difficult and a profound question, and we need to reflect on that. I mean, I had a go at the cult of leadership, because I think whatever leadership means... And I think there are times when it can, you know, be a necessary and important thing, but whatever it means, it doesn't mean saying that no matter what you guys out there vote for, I retain the right, you know, because... You know, you will just do something embarrassing or impossible or unrealistic, so I retain the right to override you. I don't think that's a serious political position to take. I don't think it's a serious way to write a constitution. I wouldn't accept that in any other area of my life. I wouldn't accept it within the church that I belong to. So if I wouldn't accept it there, why do I accept it within a political party? I find that really deeply baffling.
Okay, thanks very much. There's just something to be said here about starting earlier in the process that you mentioned, Doug, which I'd really like to agree with and echo, and just say that it's actually happening on a very small scale in East London. We're working with people, teaching people about being representatives, about what a mandate is, about being leaders, about group dynamics. And people are coming forward in their droves. We have people start a course which takes 14 weeks, and at the end of it, we have every single one of them completing. People are hungry to get involved in the public arena. Really hungry. And I'm talking about people who are Bengali, Somali, Caribbean, white working class, Turkish, Kurdish, Chinese, you name it. We work with them. And the level of hunger for engagement in the public arena is absolutely huge. We tell people that we're going to do a training. We turn people away in their hundreds from our courses because we simply haven't got the capacity to run them. Then those people become leaders. Now, what they want to talk about is the stuff that's meaningful for them. What local issue is meaningful for them. So our teenage boys want a football pitch. That's what they want that's local for them in their estate. You have to really start from where people are at. And it's not this sort of national press that's so generalist and so cruel and is just completely celebrity driven. It's of disinterest to people. And the political process panders to the media so badly that people are deeply cynical about national politics, but I tell you, on the ground, at local level, people are really keen to get involved in the public arena and want to be useful in their local communities. They want to serve.
I completely, profoundly agree with that. And people like Elizabeth in Hackney and Bob Holm in Easterhouse are my political inspirations, you know. And if we're going to spend money, if the state's going to spend money on the political process, let's spend more of it helping organisations like that, which are trying to encourage people from the ground up to learn the skills involved in organising and mobilising and being representatives and all the rest of the things she's spoken about. How much more time have we got? Is this
one
last question coming up here?
A couple of comments. I'm a card carrying Lib Dem and quite happy to be. You can't have it all ways. Pressure groups are great. They've got a wonderful place. Governments run the country, not just on the one issue. Governments run the country across the board. And it's hard being involved in the political party when, going back to what the last lady said, that the media have decided that active politicians are obviously in it for themselves. Party funding, again, you can have it both ways. You can't complain as a public at brown envelopes and then money in brown envelopes and then also complain about state funding. It's got to be one or the other, really.
Yeah, I completely disagree with that, actually. I think you can complain about both brown envelopes and say you disagree with public funding of political parties. You can say you need to humble yourselves and go back to the people, rebuild a culture of subscription, and get your mandate back from the people. I think there must be an alternative to that. Your first point I've got a lot more sympathy with. And as I say, I've been thinking aloud a bit. There's a bit of Jekyll and Hyde going on. It's been a bit of a rant. I've really appreciated the conversation, and thank you so much for your attention today.
Thank you. A round of applause for our guest speaker.